The CEO Roundtable brings together operations professionals at the top of their game to define and explore what it means to be highly effective in a scale-up organization. And what sits at the heart of it is highly curated peer-to-peer roundtables where COOs talk about things that matter.
I absolutely love my roundtable. We've been together for about 2 years, and without exaggeration, I have made friends for life.
To find out more, go to COOroundtable.com. That's COOroundtable.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Operations Room, a podcast for COOs. I am Brandon Mensinger, joined by my lovely co-host, Bethany Ayers. How are things going, Bethany?
Yeah, they're going well. I'm exhausted, Brandon.
Exhausted.
Exhausted. Because I did an epic walk in London yesterday. Have I ever mentioned my walks to you?
You have not mentioned the walks to me. I'm looking forward to this.
I will just preface, it was probably not the most entertaining thing, but it's just something that I do. So I have two friends that I do big walks with separately. They don't know each other. And the one that I did yesterday is we go to Greenwich, and there is a very good noodle shop in Greenwich. There used to be a sister one in Elephant and Castle, but it shut down with COVID, sadly. And now this is the only place to go. So what we do is we either walk from Waterloo to Greenwich, building up an appetite, and then eat our body weight in noodles, or start in Greenwich and then work off our body weight of noodles as we make our way back. And we did that. It's just lovely to walk along the Thames, see all the different parts of London that I never go to, like Wapping, if we go the North Way. I had no idea that Wapping was as nice as it is, and all these little like villages within London. And there's some areas that feel very maritime and that you're not walking along a river, but much more like a beach sensation. And maybe as an American, still not used to London, still grateful I live here 23 years on, walking along the Thames is just magical. It's still an amazing city all this time on. I can't remember who the quote's by. I'm going to guess it's Samuel Pepys, but it could be somebody else, which is when you're tired of London, you're tired of life. And there was a long time when I was tired of London, when I had young children and everything in London was hard and impossible and driving is impossible. Public transport's impossible. Life is exhausting. And I was like, London is just too hard. But now the kids are older, they're out, and I've relearning, taking advantage of it.
All right. So we have got a great topic today, which is well-being a complete waste of time? We have an amazing guest for this, which is Gethin Naden. He is a two-time best-selling author. His current book is A Work in Progress, Unlocking Well-Being to Create More Sustainable and Resilient Organizations. That is quite a mouthful. He has been called HR's most influential thinker, and he is the chief innovation officer for Benefix and Zealous. So before we get to Gethin, Bethany, I wanted to talk about two things. And the first one is a bit of a thesis that I'll put out there, which is the most effective way to improve employee mental health or wellness, as we call it, is by reducing workplace stress. And the question is, where does workplace stress come from? And I would say 80% of that responsibility to create the right environment for employees sits with the chief operating officer. I'll quickly walk through the 5 points here that the CEO has really good remit over in terms of making this fabulous for employees. The first one is flexibility and control over their work schedule, i.e. hybrid and remote.
You know I'm a fan.
Yes, you're a fan, so we're ticking that one. Yep. The second one is career progression. Is there active coaching within the organization properly to ensure that there is a track for everyone in the company that they aspire to in terms of their career? We can check that one because I'm a big fan of that. Number three is what I characterize as healthy line management. And healthy line management is the line managers representing the values of the business combined with really progressive policies. The fourth one is more of the classic operations, which is there clear alignment and focus in the organization, clear roles and responsibilities, and clear accountability? And with that, is there true empowerment and is there true autonomy? And then the last one, number five, is financial security, which is, are you compensating the employees in a way that is fair, equitable, and benchmarked? And the topper is severance packages, because ultimately employees in the organization will realize at some point whether you're screwing X employees or not based on severance packages. And if you give decent severance packages that are sensible, they'll cue into this. And this is all about financial security, where the employees in the company feel secure, both with their existing compensation, but also how they're going to be treated on the way out. What do you think, Bethany?
I agree, with a caveat that you can have all of those things in place. And if you have a toxic or fear-based culture, it really won't matter. And so there's a combination of, yes, you need to have those in place, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you will then have a good culture, because you can still have one where, and a lot of this comes from the CEO, as we've discussed previously, like if the CEO is afraid or deeply driven, we should call it maybe.
Deeply insecure.
But really like looking at it as a short-term gain or a way of making a lot of money, or like very paranoid about other people or paranoid that people are out to get them, you can have a very fear-based culture, even if middle managers know how to manage and everybody is aligned. And you can walk into businesses and know whether people are operating from a place of security and fun or operating from fear and a feeling of scarcity. If we have that foundation in place, the other five are definitely necessary. But those five without the foundation, it doesn't make it any better a place to work or any more successful a place if everybody's afraid all the time.
Yeah, or even worse, those five are actually in place and the CEO is advocating for them, but behaviorally they're undermining it with the actions that they take, which is almost doubly worse, because it's a bit of like you're presenting yourself as one image and picture for the company and for prospective employees. And in fact, it's really not the case.
It's like double talk or gaslighting. You're just like, oh, all the right things are being said, yet what I'm seeing doesn't match up to what I'm supposed to be.
Exactly. I think, to be honest, I think that is the most common scenario.
And also, like, so I think I've mentioned this book previously, and it's one that I'm always slightly worried about mentioning because I read it 10 years ago, tried to read it again, and doesn't appear to actually say what I remember that it says. But the Tribal Leadership book talks a lot about what is the point of an organization. And they have, I think, five levels, where level one is Hobbes's view of the world. Everybody's out to get you. Everything's horrible. There is no hope. And you can have different people operating at different levels within your organization. And it's kind of like who your majority is where you are. And then the second one is the world is an okay place, kind of, but like my place in it is horrible. And there's no point for me to ever do any work at all. And if you kind of think about dealing with local councils or really depressed civil servants, they often are kind of like the stereotypical people working in that level two world. Level three is where most of us operate all of the time, which is very ego driven. And so I'm okay, you're okay, but we can't both be okay at the same time. So I'm just going to tell you why I'm awesome. And then you're going to tell me why you're awesome. And we're just going to have a lot of politics around being side,
awesome,
like, parallel playing awesome.
Yeah, so far I like this book. I'm going to have to read this. So I'm curious now that the next two levels.
And then level four is where a lot of businesses aim to be, which is we are all awesome and we're working as a group against a common enemy. So Salesforce against Oracle, or Microsoft at one point against IBM. But then inside the organization, everybody's really gelling and everybody thinks everybody's awesome, but we're definitely against a common enemy. And then the fifth is this like transcendent moment that doesn't happen often, where you're just working for the betterment of the world and we're all in it together and there is no enemy and we're just like a team in flow all the time. And apparently it doesn't last very long. Don't think I've ever experienced it, but it is this like nirvana state of an organization. And I feel like if we look at and think about those levels at the same time as we're talking about what you're suggesting is in place, there can be a nice combination. If you're a level three organization, there's just loads and loads of politics going on. And again, you can have everything that you've talked about, but we all know it's an unpleasant place to be, where everybody's elbows are out. Nobody feels that secure. And it has nothing to do with the CEO. It's just that scarcity.
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. So this brings me on to thesis point number two. So if we have the core in place that I talked about and the foundation that you talked about, then the third piece of the puzzle, the 20% top up, as it were, is around optimization. And optimization in this case is wellness programs, as they're described by some of the vendors that are out there. And there's really two components of wellness to talk about. The first one is personal well-being, which is really life events. When you become a first-time dad, or somebody passes away, or you've moved city, or you've had a panic attack, and really having access to on-demand therapy and coaching that is part of the organizational corporate plan that you have, those are the hidden make-or-break moments where you can really, an organization can be tremendously helpful to an individual to help them get through those situations. And equally, on the flip side of it, for that employee to feel great about their company and feel great about the program that's being offered to them in this case. It's almost like the flip side of healthcare benefits more generally, which is, you know, you want to ensure that there's peak conditioning for you as a human being in terms of your physical ability. And this is really just the mental side of it being covered off as well. So it seems like in that sense, like a bit of a no-brainer. But on that first one, personal well-being and wellness and companies investing in that, what's your take on that?
I'm for it. I think, yeah, sounds good. So at peak, we used this Slack thing that I'm kind of keep thinking is called Dribbble, but it's not called Dribbble. I can't remember what its name is.
That is a terrible name for a product.
And it's definitely not Dribbble. I just can't remember its name. But you can Slack in and immediately speak to somebody like over Slack, but then you can also book in. And so everybody who used it just said it was amazing. And we had a couple different team members stand up and share their experiences. And so like removing the stigma of it. Everybody loved it. And I think it's really helpful for removing the stigma around therapy. Going to my back to my earlier point around like needing a lot of emotional maturity to then have an environment that everybody thrives in. The only way you're going to get emotional maturity, unless you had amazing parents, and very few of us have had amazing parents, is by doing the work and going to therapy and learning how to develop emotional maturity. And so it's a great tool to help everybody in the organization.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. You're always in a situation where you have budgets and scale-ups, and you're like, all right, I've got X amount of budget. I know that we need healthcare. There's all sorts of options and packages. So there's that world. And then there's a bit of like this new world of wellness programs. You're like, all right, yeah, this makes tremendous sense. We should be investing in that too. And by the way, we should probably try to figure out how to have career progression and some investment in that with L&D, this, that, and the other. So your mind as a CEO with your budget, you're trying to figure out how to best spend your cash. So where do you think wellness sits in this stack, I guess, of options where, you know, you're trying to figure out how to spend money?
That's an interesting question. So I think part of it is benchmarking where you're expected to be. So like pension, long-term sick. And a lot of this stuff is a lot cheaper than you realize. Death in service, none of it costs that much. And it just makes people feel better. So we did Headspace as well. And it wasn't very much per person at all. And this other mystery one that's not called Dribbble was, again, quite reasonably priced. So that made it an easy decision. But a lot of it came from benchmarking to begin with, and then like maybe some icing on top. What? How did you approach it?
We didn't think about it in terms of here's a bunch of options for employees that we need to be investing in. It was more of a piecemeal scenario. I think as a CEO going into my next company, I will think about it much more holistically around how do we want to balance our spend, because clearly we ended up shortchanging areas, not because we had decided to, but simply there was no money left, which is not a good way to do it.
I just, while you were talking, Brandon, I was 100% paying attention to you and Googling what Dribbble right. is actually called, and it's called Spill. So Spill, that was what we used.
I think they need feedback on their branding, because clearly you're associating words that are not helpful.
I don't know. But we did look at it a bit more holistically, and definitely we're approaching it of like, what's required? What are the teams looking for? And then investigating pricing. And I was just surprised at how inexpensive things were versus what I was expecting. particularly with the pension provider, like the pension provider adds all these other things onto it. And if you search well for your pension provider, like the death in service and the long-term sick and a couple other things, it was just like almost nothing compared to what you're already paying for the pension.
Okay, interesting. So the second part of this is we talked about the personal well-being. There's also the professional well-being. And in this case, how do you ensure the well-being of the line manager? How does a line manager manage for conflict? How do they deal with imposter syndrome? How do they focus under pressure? How do they build psychological safety? How do they navigate change? How do they inspire their team? How do they lead remote teams? How do they deal with burnout, et cetera, et cetera?
Easy.
So with that line manager pack there of well-being, again, some of these vendors that are out there are providing these packages as services now. They're actually actively allowing you access to a coach on an on-demand basis to help you think these issues through. And again, that seems to me like an awesome well-being package that sits at the heart and soul of companies being in a place to reduce workplace stress, which is having effective line managers because they're working on a one-to-many basis with other individuals where their impact on the company is tremendous because they're line managing six people in your company or whatever the case is. So with that second package of professional well-being, what do you think of that one?
If it's affordable, I mean, I guess that one for me is thinking it sounds really expensive all of a sudden, but I think it would make a huge difference. Like I'm very skeptical about L&D on the whole, skeptical about training. Like I guess I've just gone to almost no training in my entire career from being a junior person to a senior person that I've ever really gotten anything out of.
Yeah, I would triple down on that because my experience working for the past 10 years with HR professionals is that they have the same opinion, which is we run training programs, they are forgotten the next day and nobody cares. So it's almost like training in and of itself by itself is the worst possible investment you can make.
Yeah. Versus coaching does a lot of what I was talking about with therapy of like looking at yourself, understanding your own emotional motivations. And therefore, again, you need to be healthy yourself before you can be a good line manager for somebody else. And so offering coaching would be a way of helping people see their areas where they need to do some work or supporting people through that work.
Their potential. All right. So with that, let's move over to Gethin Naden and ask him some of these questions and tackle the topic of, is well-being a complete waste of time?
We're back with our special guest, Gethin Naden. And today we're going to be talking about, is well-being a complete waste of time? Now, before we start to answer that question, the important one is, what is well-being in the context of work? And what are we talking about?
When we look at well-being in the workplace, the majority of what we're talking about is actually, how are you structuring your organization? So you start to look at things like, is an employee adequately and frequently recognized for the job that they do? Does their manager have a great relationship with them? Do they feel like they have a community around them that can deliver that psychological safety? Do they have open and honest conversations and vulnerability with their manager? Are expectations clear? You know, is the organization basically set up and designed to serve the well-being of people? I mean, if you look at something like the reasons why people get burnt out, and you have around 90 to 99% of people said that they've experienced extreme or a lot of stress in the last 12 months.
Did you say 99?
Yeah. So it's like everybody's experienced extreme stress. And those research pieces that have been looking at that, this isn't the same thing every year. So right across the US, right across Europe, you can see that people are stressed at work more than they've ever been. Now, the reasons why somebody gets stressed at work can be really complex. I mean, in the UK at the moment, there is, and lots of other countries, there's a cost of living crisis, which is putting a big financial squeeze on people, which is leading more people to be unhappy with their employer because they feel like the only way out of this situation is to get more money. And so they're putting pressure on the employers to get higher wages to buy themselves literally out of this problem. Now, employers didn't cause the cost of living crisis, same as employers didn't cause the pandemic. But it's affecting work and people are bringing that home. You know, we've literally brought home and worked together over the last couple of years. And so we can't separate those two things again. And so there's this weird mix of things the employers want to support with, but probably isn't caused by them, or you could argue is their responsibility fix. And I put money in that bucket. And then you've got the things that the employers really focus on. And I think for most employers now, we're trying to move away from this idea of do no harm. So that is basically the idea that somebody shouldn't have poor well-being because of something you've done as an employer, which would include bad management, workload, unclear expectations, lack of recognition, to do better, which is actually, how can I, as the employer, take up this mantle I've been given to maybe do more and be more effective in people's lives than the government currently is, regardless of which country you're living in at the moment, and actually create an environment where if somebody comes to work with me, their life is better off because they chose to work with me. And I think employers are on this sliding scale of you come to work, you get paid, forget it. That's the end of the transaction, which is the old way of working. And then this really progressive, if you're worried about money, if it's affecting your life and your happiness, then my attitude as a responsible employer is I want to help you solve that if I can do that. And by doing so, you'll be more loyal to me. You'll develop better products. You'll deliver better customer service. And we're stuck on this kind of journey, which some people are going through at the moment. But fundamentally, the organizational structure pieces are things like managing workloads, expectations, good relationship with your team and manager. They're all the kind of basic well-being needs that most of us have. And if you get those settled, you have a really good environment and culture of well-being. But then there's the other stuff down the end where actually, you know, somebody bringing their dog into the office might actually give them quite a bit of joy. So all of those things are important. It's not just a case of we pick and choose the easy ones to do and leave the rest behind.
So there was a Guardian article recently citing an Oxford study suggesting that wellness programs were a waste of time. And the thesis in the article is that workplace stress is derived primarily from shitty operational practices as opposed to anything else, and that wellness programs are simply papering over the cracks, and that statistically, at least, no discernible impact on job satisfaction for employees. And I just wanted to get your sense of that and whether or not you agree with the Guardian article.
I don't actually. So I think the short answer would be, yes, it depends on the circumstance. So if you treat your people like absolute shit, you don't give them any flexibility, you don't train your managers well, your expectation is you come, you get your money, you leave, and that's the end of this transaction. That's the as far as the relationship goes. You give people unclear expectations, you put too much pressure on them, you give them more workload than they can manage. If you do all of those things and then tell people they can bring their puppy to the office or say, look, we paid for a mindfulness app, then what you're doing there is actually, that's wrong. Right? And I think most people who've got any experience of well-being or anyone with half a brain would look at that and say, well, yeah, that's, you're papering over the cracks. So this is not, it's not an acceptable way of operating. And the Oxford study is basically, in my view, making the assumption that that's what all companies are doing. If you're offering a mindfulness app, then you're just papering over the cracks of the damage that you've already caused your people. And I just don't think that's right, because I think I work with a lot of global employers, and a lot of them have, I would describe as very positive cultures of well-being that do an awful lot to take care of their people, that do all the things we've mentioned are important. They structure their organizations to the best they can in the right way. But if you work in a customer service role, you will still get a customer that will wind you up and upset you, even in the most positive environment that you could work in. You know, I'm sure if you work at Disneyland, somebody's going to piss you off at some point. And so we've all got this kind of barometer for how much you can deal with, and you might kind of snap back at a customer and get stressed. I mean, I've worked for the company for 13 years that I work for at the moment, and I've been very engaged there. What I would actually say probably one of their most engaged employees for that entire length of time. And the reason why I've been there for so long doesn't mean that I haven't had days where I felt really overwhelmed and stressed by my job. In many cases, that brought on by myself and the standard that I hold myself to. So I make myself stressed. And so to say that if you have a really good organization that does all the right things, you will not have any well-being issues, I think doesn't take into account the fact that stress is actually part of our lives and part of our work lives. And even in the best environments, that's not going to disappear. But also that people will hold themselves accountable. People will burn out through sometimes their own causes, or the research tells us it's mostly organizational issues that cause that. But, you know, high performers are at high risk of well-being because, again, they tend to hold themselves more accountable. They delegate less. They take on more work. They don't like to say no to people. And so, you know, to say that, you know, putting mindfulness in place and not doing all this structural stuff, I get that. But mindfulness and doing the structure stuff is really good. I mean, mindfulness is one of the most evidenced well-being initiatives that we have, not just at the workplace, but anywhere. You know, it's a huge, huge body of evidence to prove how effective that is at managing anxiety, symptoms of depression, lowering heart rates, reducing cardiovascular risk, all these great things. So for us to just draw a line through that, through one study and say, do you know what, I don't think workplace well-being works. Yeah, it's a combination of all the things we've talked about. The opposite would be true if you did all the organizational structure stuff right, but didn't help people manage stress. you would still have some issues to solve. So I think it's a combination of all these things. And clearly there's some priority over the things you should be doing first versus less. But I think for us to look at one study and throw all of our well-being strategies out is a mistake. And I think the attention that particular study has had, I think that risks happening. I think people start to realize this is not worth investing in. And I think that would be a big mistake.
I'm still surprised that 99% are affected, just because not all 99% are super. I guess maybe it's just like, I feel like I'm special and I'm specially, you know, burnt out because I'm a high achiever and I'm a woman and dealing with a lot of feelings of being excluded or have been felt excluded in my life. So one, I guess we haven't talked about the DEI side of things, and that there's when you are actively discriminated against, there's a massive toll on your body. And I think that's something that we should talk about as part of the structures that we should put in place for everybody.
Anyone who belongs to a marginalized group tends to have mental health that's worse than the general population and has had experiences at work that have affected their well-being. Social exclusion is an incredibly important contributor to poor mental health amongst loads of different protected and marginalized groups in society. And so when we don't include people and we actively exclude them, that has a really significant impact. But it's not just about inclusion and diversity. It's about, again, what policies and structure are we putting in place that better serve those traditionally marginalized groups? And so if we just, I mean, take two examples. So women have been sexually harassed, which if you look at the data is...
Yeah, everyone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so when you start to look at how organizations are structured, if you look at things like sexual harassment policies, ensuring that they're in place and they're worded in such a way that they help to contribute to a culture where women feel safe to speak up about the experiences that they have in work, that they don't fear that by speaking up about their manager, that's going to be held against them or they're going to be demoted for it, and all these kind of terrible things that tend to happen when women do speak up. So again, that's a structural change that needs to take place, and quite a big one in most companies, because most companies aren't currently set up for that. But again, it's a policy thing. It's not an app that you can go out and buy. It's a policy, a change you need to make, which is what kind of manager am I going to employ? I mean, a really good example of a workplace where this is really complicated at the moment is the UK police force. So the UK police force has come under a huge amount of fire recently for the structure of racism, misogyny that has been deeply bedded into the police force in the UK. Numerous different independent reports have found this out. We've had fairly high profile, active ranking police officers that have been fired over the last couple of years because of the way that they've treated women, or because they've raped women or murdered women.
Or beaten their wives, and everybody's just looked the other way. Yeah.
And so that's a really good environment where actually, if you ask the women why they didn't speak up or why they didn't say anything, one of the most common answers is, I thought it was part of this kind of laddish behavior that was expected in the police force, and it was just banter, and I was a junior officer and I didn't feel like I could speak up. So culturally, there's a huge shift happening, and this is happening in lots of big institutions, historic institutions around the world. But a really good example of that doesn't just change overnight. You don't just sit in front of your women who work with you and say, oh, just speak up if it happens and we'll do something about it. You have to demonstrate that you are A, capable and willing to do something about it. So hold those people who've been historically had complaints against them to task and move them out of the organization. And again, some of that stuff can take time. It was really complicated. But if you're a woman at the end of any one of those kind of negative experiences that we've just talked about, your mental health would have declined because of that. So if you really want to help the mental health of your staff, you've got to focus on half your population, which will be women, and you've got to focus on the things that are holding women back in the workplace. And that's, you know, one of the many examples, unfortunately, that's happening. But it starts to show how kind of complex it can get. But it, certainly diversity and inclusion plays a role. And I guess if you take another issue like trans inclusion, you don't just recruit trans people into your organization. You have to create a culture that is welcoming and safe for trans employees before they will come and work with you. And so again, you have to think about how you write policies, what additional policies you'll put in place, maybe down to the benefits that you'll offer. You know, will you include gender reassignment surgery as part of your health insurance? You know, all these kind of things that you need to consider. But you create a safe and welcoming environment for different diverse people so that they will want to come and work with you, and their mental health and overall health won't suffer because of the way that they've been treated probably historically and previously at other organizations.
And also, one of the things that I find quite difficult is, and this is maybe a bit of our question of round, like how much is the company's responsibility versus taking on responsibility that's actually societal? A certain amount of at least my experience with DEI is around this. and trans rights would definitely be a part of this, of within an organization, you hope to act better than the outside world and not to be a microcosm of society within the business. But actually, as a leader, it becomes very quickly apparent that even if your policies are right, your intentions are better than society's, you want to be as inclusive as possible. We are all companies that are made up of people who are in these societies, unconscious bias, ways that we act, internalized misogyny within women as much as men, internalized racism within people of color as much as white people, means that actually acting in the right way and being better than society becomes very difficult. And it becomes a question of what can we do without getting so disillusioned we can't do anything anymore versus what changes can we make outside of work?
I'm a big believer in the power of the workplace, I think, in many instances, is stronger than the state. I think in most countries, the state has been failing people for about the last decade across the various different measures. Another case study, if you look at the US and you look at the overturning of Roe versus Wade, as soon as that happened, huge numbers of big employers across the US came out and said, if you work for me and you're a woman that needs to have an abortion, I will give you the time off to have that abortion, and I will give you the funding so that you can go and travel to a state where it is legal and have that done safely. And so what you start to see is these examples of employers stepping up and actually turning against, in that example, the US government, and saying, the decision you've made, I don't want that to happen in my four walls. I don't think that was the right decision to make. We've seen the same thing with Disney standing up to lawmakers in Florida about LGBTQ plus inclusion. We've done similar things when Donald Trump decided to try and go on this kind of anti-immigrant pathway as soon as he came into power. And people like Patagonia stood up and said, you know what? Actually, if you want access to our lawyers for free to fight your case, we're going to give you that because we support you. And so I think there's these growing numbers of examples where employers are becoming almost activists against some of the government decisions that are being made because they want to better protect their employees and create this safe space. And I think it's really clever because it's morally the right thing to do, in my view. But also, when you look at most people actually want to work in a diverse environment because most people were nowadays, younger people especially, were brought up in diverse environments. They lived in largely diverse schools and communities, and so they want the workplace to represent that. And so if you look at most of the data, most people want to work in a diverse environment, even if they're not in a diverse group themselves. And so that's kind of part of it. But also, I think one of the things that we kind of need to get some managers over and some leaders over is actually what are the business drivers for this? So putting kind of morality to one side, there is a whole host of data that tells us that actually diverse groups and diverse teams are more productive and more innovative. They collaborate more. And we can see kind of things like shareholder returns and profits and investor returns all linked to more diverse teams. And I do wonder if more managers understood that their performance relied on their team becoming diverse, whether they would start to change.
It feels like in 2024, the social contract between employees and employers has changed. And I think there's a lot of catch up happening with people's mindsets. And in particular, you know, even talking about inclusivity right now, this question of where corporate responsibility starts to tail off and personal responsibility starts to kick in. I think that goal line has now shifted. This question of wrapping leaders' minds around the fact that the world has shifted and that they need to now shift to accompany that and spend on that. This is always where we get caught out, I think, which is, hey, we're a company, we're responsible for A, B, and C. D and F is not our job and it's not our responsibility. And we're going to leave that aside. It's not business, so therefore we're not going to spend money on that in particular. If we're trying to be profitable companies with margins and we want a return on investment, to your point around how do we achieve that and what is worthwhile investing in from a corporate standpoint, how to approach this new world and investing in things that actually do in fact matter for the bottom line?
So I think the answer was in the question. So if you're a profit-making business, if you're trying to generate revenue and shareholder return, then your reason for being is whatever gets you to that point, right? And what we're saying through all of this is there's a different way and a new, better way to get to that same point. And it doesn't mean putting too much pressure on people. It doesn't mean excluding people. It's not putting money before people. Actually, there's an enhanced route to profitability by investing in people first, and a huge amount of data to back this up. That, I mean, I did some work pre the second book to really look at what people's strategies around the world were designed for before the pandemic and what a successful business looks like kind of through and following the pandemic. And what I generally found out is that most old people strategies were designed for the employer. So it was, how do you use your investment in people to better serve the company? Now, when you look at the outline of a modern progressive business that is also successful, they tend to be designed for the employee. So they're like basically saying, how do I give the employee everything they need to be successful? And then they will be successful. And so all this heavy evidence is saying that's actually the modern, more effective way to create a profit-generating or successful company by whatever measure you want to pick of each of those things that might mean success for you as a company. And so that means actually this kind of people-centered environment that we've been hearing a lot of over the last couple of years, the idea that if I put the person at the center of my business, if I help them solve problems, if I make them feel well and included and safe, then everything else will come into place. And I think that's what many leaders are grappling with, is that's not the way they were brought up. That's not the way they were taught to manage. You know, when I was a manager, you know, you were the highest paid, most influential person in the team. Take a sports team, right? You can take one of your sports team out and your sports players will be more famous and well-known and well-paid than the coach will be. And we just don't necessarily look at it in the same way in the workplace.
I think there's a really important point here to be made, because I feel like we want the best operational practices for our company. So is a line manager being highly effective being a line manager? Is there clarity in roles and responsibility? There's all sorts of standard operational practices that we think deeply about to achieve success for companies. And that corporate responsibility line, where we now are thinking about a wellness program for crisis intervention, whereby if that person's relationship with their partner is going off the rails, so somehow the company is now responsible for that. This is where the rubber hits the road a little bit, because intuitively, it doesn't make sense to me. Why would I be responsible for somebody's partner, whatever, their relationship? That's not a company issue. That's their personal issue. But what we're saying now is that with wellness, that is directly what it starts to address in this case. And the reason why that's useful, and I can answer this question myself right now, but I'll pass it to you. Why is that useful?
It might not be a company's responsibility, but it's also okay, maybe, to teach mindfulness or have mindfulness apps, resilience, and basically give people a bit of perspective. And Brandon, I'm talking about a bit of like what you're talking about, of maybe your example of you've had a fight with a partner or breaking up with a partner, and it's suddenly the business's responsibility. I don't think it is. Although even if I cast my mind back to a horrific breakup that I had at 23 or whatever in 2003, I had a couple of days off work unofficially because I was just like in meltdown stage. And I think that businesses do treat you like very confused young people early in your careers and throughout. I'm just wandering now with loads of ideas and thoughts, and I'll get to my question in a second, I hope. I guess for me, one is, have things actually changed that much? Or are we just always, we've been humans at work and we treat each other like humans, and some businesses are better at treating people like humans than others. And now we have more words for it. And now we can offer something called mindfulness, which is basically a way of finding perspective and resilience. And that helps our employees at work. And it also helps our employees as people outside of work. And that's good for everyone, whether or not it's our responsibility. No question. Thoughts?
I don't really care if somebody thinks it's their responsibility or not. I believe it is. And I believe if they don't pay attention to that, and the heavy evidence we now have that it makes a difference to your organization by any number of success measures, that if you take care of your people, you get better results regardless of what industry you're in or what success looks like for you. I think it would be a mistake to ignore that. I think any employer that says, no, it's too paternalistic. I mean, let's look at any relationship you might have in your life, right? I think the employer-employee is a relationship. You would measure some of your best friends by how they rallied around. So if you take your example, Beth, you know, the people who said that breakup was pretty tough on you, and I know that, what can I do for you? Let's take you out for coffee. Let's go on a night out. Let's go away for the weekend. You know, I'm here to talk. The people that were not there for you then, who stayed silent through that tough time, they're the people you start to question, are these really friends or are these just performative people in my life that actually, when it came to the crunch, they weren't there for me? What happened during the pandemic, and we've got a lot of data to back this up, is people started thinking like that about their employer. So for the first time ever, we had this really good case study, which is actually, if it all ended now, am I happy with my life? And people had this period of quiet reflection where lots of people came to the conclusion that I wouldn't be happy what I'm doing with the person I'm doing it for. And so the reason why we had that kind of great resignation was driven by the idea that lots of people said, do you know what, if I die tomorrow and this is how my last day ended, I don't want to be working for this asshole. I don't want to be working for this shitty company. And I think that's the decisions lots of people made, which we can see in the US in particular, the number of people following the tail end of the pandemic that quit their job without another job to go to hit record highs. Where those people basically saying, do you know what? No job is worth my mental health. I'm putting myself first and I'm going to quit. And we saw that happen a great deal. And even in the UK now, if you look at the recession we've gone into, people are still quite comfortable leaving jobs, even though finding their next one might not be as easy as it once was. And so people are really prioritizing themselves. And I think to Brandon's earlier point about the social contract, I think it hasn't changed. I think it's broken down. You know, the deal was you go to work and you'll be able to put roof over your head. You'll be able to get a mortgage. You'll be able to put food in your belly and do all the things, the fun trappings of modern life, like go on holiday and go on day trips and buy nice clothes or whatever a happy looks like to you. And for millions, hundreds of millions of people, that's not happening anymore. And so if the deal was you go to work and you work really hard and you get all these just desserts and stuff, then that's great. But actually, if you look at most people no longer believe that if they work hard, they will get the rewards like their parents did. We can go into this whole conversation about capitalism and the distribution of that and all that kind of stuff. But generally speaking, that contract has broken down because I'm just not getting the stuff from work anymore. But then when you overlay that with what do people want from work, our own research at Benefex found globally, we spoke to 7,000 people in six different countries. The number one thing they said they were looking for from a new employer was a commitment to well-being. This idea that I want to be working for the right person when the next pandemic comes along, so they do all the right things by me. So I'm not working for the company that my friend did, who actually made them take a pay cut and kind of made some terrible decisions for them. And so I think that's really, really interesting where we're happening and where we are at the moment with that, is that actually people are expecting more from their employer and the employer has to meet those expectations because you won't get the best talent and the best talent tend to have the most options. So they're not going to choose the rubbish employers. They're going to gravitate towards the really progressive ones that if, like you, Beth, they go through a breakup or a divorce and life gets difficult, the employer says, you know what? You're a great employer. You've done loads for us. Whatever you need, take the time you need, however we can help, we want to do that. And when you're back on your feet, you come back to work and everything's great again. And why wouldn't you want to work with that person?
And also, one of the things that I find really interesting, having made the transition from being a bit more of a get back to work kind of manager to a more supportive, bring my whole self to work, and it's okay for you to bring your whole self to work manager or leader, is that it's just a lot more rewarding to make real connections and to build an environment that people want to be in and that you want to be in and that you see people as humans and we're all just working together to a common goal. And as a leader, it lowers your stress to not have to put on this mantle of something that either you don't believe in or pushing people needlessly. So just for our listeners out there, I'd encourage them, whether or not you're changing the policies, because not everybody's an HR leader, just be a little bit more human at work and see how it makes you feel.
I can imagine, Bethany, you know, you 20 years ago, just being a phenomenal individual contributor. I would want to give you every possible tool to allow you to flourish within the organization, whether it's personal or professional, which gets to this idea of well-being, right? So if Bethany's going through a breakup right now, I'd want to make sure you have everything that you need to respond because it has a dramatic impact on the professional. Because if you're off for 2 days or a week or whatever, and this is not a time-based thing that I'm talking about, but just generally speaking, I want you to be hugely successful and I want the company to be successful and whatever tooling is required to make that happen, let's do that. Let's optimize for that. And I think that's kind of what you're saying, Gethin.
Yeah, the optimization, I think, is a really key word here as well, because historically, employers have been very good at mitigating risk. So if Beth, 20 years ago, had broken her leg and couldn't come to work, you might have some kind of health insurance that would kick in, because the idea is, well, I want you back at work as quickly as possible because I don't have somebody to backfill and that's going to cost me money. So I'll put health insurance in place to protect me as the employer, as well as you, to make sure that you get the best care and you get back to work and you're working effectively as quickly as possible. It's a different side of the same coin. We're looking at basically, what do I need to do to get that person back to performing? And if any of us, even the most archaic view of any old manager, that if you had a great employee that was working for you and their quality started to slip, and I actually had a really good example of this with a customer I worked with, a financial services firm in Scotland. They had a really good employee, been there for about 3 or 4 years, high performing employee, quality and output started to decline. They had a few performance conversations. The manager went to HR and said, look, we've got to get rid of this guy. He's just not performing anymore. And they sat down with him and said, there must be a reason for this. You know, this was a high performer before and now isn't. And so the employee relations team took over and they started having a few kind of sessions with him. And it turned out to be a divorce. His wife had left him. He was finding it really difficult to manage. And so they basically agreed with him that they would give him, 3 to 6 months off paid to deal with his mental health. They offered him lots of other support as well. He then came back and within 12 months was not just back to being the great performing employee again, but ended up becoming the manager of the team that he was once a part of. So a very successful individual. Now, most people would not push through that barrier to invest in people. But the view there was he was a very good employee. And with the right help from us, he'll be a very good employee again. And actually, that's a much, much easier transition to go through than to get that somebody out and get somebody back in. Because employees appreciate assets. You know, they hit their optimum levels really at about 2 years, if you listen to what people like Josh Burson says. So somebody who'd been there for 3 years and was high performing, you'd be mad to let that person go. But what you're basically saying is, well, actually, with a few tweaks and a little bit of time, we can get this person to performing as good as they were. And in my world, when we talk about employee well-being, we are talking about how do we optimize people? So it's not always about how do you mitigate risks. So you've got someone in crisis and I need to solve them. Actually, most employees don't have a mental health problem. Most employees aren't so stressed out they can't handle it. You know, 80%-ish of employees are just what we call kind of languishing. They're not massively happy, but they're not massively unhappy or ill either. But with a few tweaks, we could actually get them to what we call employee functioning, which is actually if I can get them to sleep a little bit better, if I can get their relationships to be a bit better, if I can get them to be a little bit less worried about the pressures life is putting on them, I actually get a lot more out of them as a team manager and as a CEO. I start to optimize people more and they really benefit from that too. And mindfulness is, you know, one of those tools that really starts to optimize people. I think that's, you know, back drawing full circle of where we started. That's an example of something that actually optimizes people. So it's such a big area and it's really like kind of complex. But I think most managers aren't privy to the kind of data and conversations we've had today. Most people aren't sitting down with their managers and saying what you did, Beth, which is actually, you know, if we expose a little bit of vulnerability and we take a little bit of time or a bit more patient and kinder with people, that actually leads to better organization output. You know, we're still thinking of this 1970s Peter Drucker, which is, you know, businesses operate for profit and they don't do anything else. You know, I'm actually really interested in, especially when you look at environmental, social, government and any kind of CSR activities, the role that well-being plays in that. So the better treatment of people and the impact it has on society. Because I really believe that the more an employer can invest in a great employee experience at work, the better societies and communities that we live in do because of that. And there's some really interesting research I pulled together for the book around fathers who get good quality and frequent recognition in the workplace have better relationships with their children. One study that looked at communities in the in Australia, where if you could improve the employee experience of people living in a different house in one street, you started to actually see them to start displaying more community-based activities. So they cooked for each other, they had more parties and barbecues and invited each other to cookouts and things like that. And so you can actually start to see the role that the employer plays. And I think if you take, again, like the pressure on the NHS, the National Health Service in the UK at the moment, the question I ask lots of my customers and lots of the talks I do is, if the employer is not going to take care of your well-being, who is? And to try and illustrate this for a conference talk I've got coming up in a couple of months, I timed how long it would take me to do certain things at government level versus if I went to my employer to ask for the same help. And recently was left waiting for 35 minutes to try and get a doctor's appointment on the National Health Service. I actually gave up before they even answered the phone. Yet through my health insurance, through my employer, I was able to get a video doctor meeting within 15 minutes. The only reason I had to wait 15 minutes was for them to set the call up effectively. You know, it kind of got agreed within minutes. And we see the same thing with loads of the benefits most employers offer. They can get you access to a counsellor tomorrow, whereas on the NHS, your current waiting time is 6 months plus. And so again, it's starting to see like, actually, who would you rather work for? The employer that did all those things or the ones that just left you to their own devices and said, sorry, Beth, I know your mental health has been shot to shit because of that breakup, but you're on your own. Why would you work with that person?
It's interesting that just for those examples that you've given, that basically as employers, we have the ability to create the world that we can't vote our government into creating for us. We're rapidly running out of time, Gethin, and so I just want to ask our final question, which is we've covered so many topics today. If our listeners were going to take one thing away from our chat, what would that be?
I think it'd be exactly what you said. I think a lot of this stuff is structural. It can be expensive and timely to change. And I think lots of companies, as I mentioned, are on that journey from kind of really not progressive and quite ancient to really progressive. And we can all present the data and try and encourage more employers to invest in that and link it to CSR and ESG and investor activity and consumer activity. We can do all these great things, but in some, most organizations, that might not be you, the listener today. It might be somebody else who's making those decisions. You know, have no influence, but everybody listening has the kind of influence that you talked about, Beth, which is I can treat people with a little bit more kindness. I can be there for my team members. I can give them a little space. So if somebody's quality has slipped or they get a bit angry with me where they weren't necessarily angry before, I can maybe kind of understand that life weighs heavy on people sometimes, especially at the moment. And so giving people a bit more grace and space and just being a bit kinder just makes the world of difference. My mother's been recently diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and that's probably the biggest well-being challenge I've ever had, and I've really struggled with that. But I've been really open with my team about whether it's a good day and it's a bad day, and just making them aware of not necessarily all the details, but the challenges that exist in my life, because I know that if I don't do that, they won't feel able to and trust to open up to me. And if they don't open up to me, I can't be a better manager for them. If I know more about what's challenging them, I can put some things in place or make some decisions that will better serve them. And a really good example of how somebody did that recently is when my dad was really overwhelmed with this diagnosis. He really wanted some time away. So me and my brother took my dad away for a couple of days, took him to London just for a couple of days out. When my brother's boss found out about that, he said, oh, what are you going to London for? He explained, we're taking my dad away to give him a break from caring for my mum. And the boss was like, I hope you're not taking that for annual leave. Don't mark that as holiday. You have those 2 days. It's not a policy change. It's not a HR didn't get involved. CEO didn't get involved. That was one manager saying, the right thing here is this person shouldn't be giving up their own holiday just to care for somebody that, you know, it's not their fault that it's happened. And that's the essence, I think, of what we're trying to do with most people is just, yes, give people a break and treat them with a little bit more empathy and kindness.
Lovely. So thank you, Gethin, for joining us on the Operations Room. And I really appreciate this conversation because I feel like some of the macro trends that we've talked about on the podcast have really kind of connected some dots for me that have closed off some open-ended questions that I had in my head, to be honest. And I just really appreciate the time that we spent today. So if you like what you hear, please subscribe or leave us a comment, and we will see you next week.